Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The music business isn't easy. No matter how talented you are, it's a struggle to get to the top, if you get to the top. But struggle is something our guest this hour has been familiar with since birth, and against all odds, he made it in Nashville. Well, I say he made it because he's appeared 14 times on the Grand Ole Opry and has had three singles on the Billboard Hot Country chart, along with several albums to his credit. But that's not exactly how he puts it. Listen to what he says about himself in the opening moments of a new documentary about his life.
I've always done for a living what I would have gladly done for free. I've toured the world, sold hundreds of thousands of records. I've written songs recorded by superstars. Still, most people don't know who the hell I am. My name is Rocky Lynn, and this is my story. It's all about timing, I think. Being in the right place at the right time, or the wrong place, just accepting what happens and moving forward with purpose. Of course, you can't pick your starting point. You can't choose where you're born. You just have to make the best of it. I grew up here in the little town of Statesville, North Carolina. I lived here through high school, then left to look for fame and fortune. I was drawn back a few decades later to untangle my tangled roots.
That documentary is streaming right now on Amazon Prime and will be shown on PBS in the fall, but we're going to spend some time exploring the tangled roots of Rocky Lynn Rash this hour. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to visit with you.
You're very welcome. J.C. Summerford is also here. She is the writer, producer, director, creator of that documentary, Rocky Lynn, Where I Belong. Welcome to you as well, J.C. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So, Rocky, you just said that most people don't know who you are, but you have all these accomplishments to your credit, like selling the hundreds of thousands of records that you alluded to a few moments ago. You were featured as a Good Morning America's breakout artist. You had songs picked up by network TV shows and used shows like Criminal Minds. If no one knows you, how does any of this make sense?
Well, I was tongue in cheek there with that response, but I think it's interesting that that when you played that montage of parts from the beginning of the documentary there, I almost got the idea that I think I know what I'm doing, but I don't at all.
No, I think that's not true.
I just love guitar and I love music, and my whole goal in life is to learn how to play, and that's what I'm trying to do. And I think whatever recognition comes or doesn't come from it is just a byproduct of getting to do something that you love from your heart. And that's what our film is about encouraging people with a dream to never put that dream aside.
As we will find as we go on through this conversation, I think you can check off, learn to play the guitar. You can take that off your to-do list. I think you've accomplished that. JC, you worked with Rocky when he was asked to host a makeover show for A&E called Operation Build. I think you were a script writer for that production. But how did you learn about Ricky's backstory, which obviously made you interested in doing a documentary about him?
Well, I'm sort of glad you brought that story up. It was one of my favorite Rocky stories. Actually, I was the senior producer on this television series. Okay. It was called Operation Build. And we had just lost our host, Alexi. She quit, and we were using guest hosts for a while. And one of our field directors, Colin Williams, said he hired Rocky to host a couple of the episodes. And he said, "Hey, JC, take a look at this guy. What do you think about him as host of the show?" And my response was, and I'm going to clean it up a little bit here, but I said, "What in the world is he doing hosting our stupid show? He should have his own show." And then we got to talking, met with Susan and Rocky and came up with a great idea for a TV series. And meanwhile, I said, but you know what? First, let's produce a documentary, a great documentary, because by that time I had gotten to know him a lot. And I said, I know a great story when I hear one. I want to do this first. And then maybe down the road, we do the TV series. So that's how we got started.
We're going to take folks through Rocky's story. So I don't want to give it all away at the very beginning of the program. But you say his story is the stuff of American folklore. That could not be more true. It is also the stuff of country music, it strikes me. His entire life could be a very long country music song. But his story would also fit the mold of a rocker or even a classical musician. It is a classic American story. JC.
Yes, I mean, of course, Rocky is not relegated only to rock, country music.
Right.
He started out doing rock music. As you see in the show, one of my favorite parts of the show, in fact, is showing him out in L.A. in his L.A. days when he was playing in all these hair bands. And he doesn't like this footage as much as I do, but I love these scenes of him dressed in a tiger skin latex outfit with that long hair flying around, and he's just shredding it on stage. This is some of the coolest footage you'll ever see. It just takes you back to the 80s, right, Rocky?
Well, I remember putting on that ridiculous spandex leotard and thinking at the time, this is going to come back to me one day. And sure enough, it did.
Well, let me ask you about that, because a lot of those rockers back then were wearing the spandex and the sparkle and the exaggerated eye makeup and things like that. Kiss comes to mind. Do they know? Did they know then? Clearly you did, that this is just over the top weird, but it's a gimmick and we got to have a gimmick. Is that what it was all about?
Well, I've always been about 10 minutes late to the party, Mike. And so the only way that I could get out to California to go, I wanted to go to a guitar school called GIT. And the way that I could get out there was by going in the United States Army. I got out of the Army in 86, and in 87, I headed to California to be Eddie Van Halen. That was my plan. And that's where the spandex came from, because that's where all the people out there were wearing. But unfortunately, the hair metal thing had kind of gone, and they were all looking for Nirvana and people like that. So I was definitely the fish out of the water for a couple reasons. One, because I wanted to do music that was a couple years old. And two, I was a kid from Troutman in Statesville, North Carolina, in the middle of Los Angeles, which is as big a culture shock as you could imagine.
Yeah. Let's start at the beginning, because your story is a linear one that really you need to appreciate the beginning to truly appreciate where we are today. It's not the end of the story. It's just you're in the middle of your story right now. But the beginning of your story is when you were left on the doorstep of the Barium Springs Home for Children. How old were you when that happened to you, Rocky?
I was just a few days old, and I was found, I guess, in a basket or something at the foot of the laundry at Barium Springs Home for Children. So I was just a couple days old. I don't have any memory of it, obviously.
And you were later adopted by the Southern Baptist family, as we'll discover in the course of this documentary. You will eventually find your biological family. But how different were your adoptive parents from the family that you have come to know?
Well, my adopted parents were such a godsend for me and such a blessing. You know, I was a little boy, a little older child, and usually the older ones don't get adopted. And I was fortunate enough to be adopted by Fred and Ethel Rash in Statesville, North Carolina. And it was the first time, you know, that people had cared if I had clean clothes or a place to sleep or, you know, a food. Regularly, it was a blessing to me. And that's the reason we're back in Nashville now. I mean, back in Statesville now, we're here caring for the gentleman that adopted me. He's 91 years old, and we came back here to help him. So in my later years, I'm getting to return that love that he showed to me all those years ago.
How old were you when they adopted you?
I don't know, and it's a little unclear, oddly enough. I was just a young boy, a toddler, I would say.
Okay.
And then for many, many years, I didn't have a family. And as you said, we were able to find, in the course of this movie, they found my my birth parents, my father and my mother. And so now I have an extended family. And, that could have ended a bunch of different ways. You know, we didn't very nervous in reaching out to make sure that we didn't pop into somebody's life and ruin something or change somebody's perspective of it. But fortunately for me and for us, all of my extended family just wrapped their arms around me. So at Thanksgiving, you know, we go to the church up in Wilkesboro and there's cousins and nephews and an entire feeling, because prior to that, it was just this small unit. And now it's like I'm from somewhere. I'm somebody.
You just said this a moment ago, but in the movie, in the documentary, you say that your adoptive mother was the first person who ever cared if you had anything to wear or anything to eat. Tell us more about her.
My adoptive mother was an extremely smart, wonderful lady, but she only had a third grade education. And my adoptive dad, he finished the fifth grade as well. So they're both Depression era people that grew up hard. They weren't intelligent. They were very hardworking. It's just a tough time to grow up during the Depression. So we struggled. We lived on a dirt road in Statesville, North Carolina. My mama made all the food. She had a garden. We grew the food, and we would, my dad and his brother would have a cow and a pig that we would harvest once a year. So it was very much like old school living from her. And she had very traditional Southern values and a very deep faith in the Lord. And I think that was a good upbringing for me.
And you do tell us more about your mom in a song that you wrote and first released, I believe, in 2007, called More. You co-wrote that song with a man named Dennis Morgan and released it, as I said, in 2007, just as your record company was going under. It was just starting to get airplay. So let's hear that.
You say I am your everything, the half that makes you whole. You say you love me with all your heart, your body and your soul. You say your love is an ocean without any shore. You ask how much I love you. I love you more.
That's the original, but you recently re-recorded the song for your latest album, Love, and this time around you took a slightly different approach.
Give every ounce of blood in my body, drag you out from the
Yeah, the original seems simpler, perhaps more raw. The new one is maybe more commercial as a way to say it. I have 30 seconds here, but why the different approach?
It sounds like somebody found a drum set, Mike.
Are you the producer of the new
back like that? I like apparently I like that snare drum a lot. You know, it sounds like I do anyway.
We kind of gave it short shrift. We didn't hear enough of the new version to make any kind of a judgment. But I want to talk more about More, which is the song that you wrote about your adoptive mother, when we come back. Because I talked over a lyric, at least to me, that was pretty important. I give up my seat on the train to heaven if only one of us can go. I want to talk about that and more when we come back with Rocky Lynn Rash. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Rocky Lynn Rash, the subject of a brand-new documentary that is now streaming on Amazon Prime, Rocky Lynn, Where I Belong, which was written, produced, directed, created by our other guest, J.C. Summerford. And he also has a brand new album out to accompany this documentary called Love. We just played a cut, two versions of a song called More, the original back in 2007 and the most recent version about your adoptive mother. And as I said, I talked over a key lyric in that song, at least to me. I'd give up my seat on the train to heaven if only one of us can go. You say it's a truth.
Well, that's what she always said to me, Mike. Her whole life, you know, my mom, I would say to her, I love you, Mama. And she would say back, she'd say, well, I love you more. And that was the idea that I had. And then when she passed away, I remember at the funeral, I was with my daughter. She's just a little girl at the time, you know, and I just said, this is what I realized what she meant. She meant she loved me more than herself. And I wanted to somehow or another put that in a song. And then I was fortunate enough, you know, to, like you said, I wrote it with Dennis Morgan, who is in the Nashville Songwriter Hall of Fame. He's a mentor of mine, has been writing with me for a long time. And I had that chorus. I had the I'd give you my seat on the train to heaven if only one of us could go. And I had the verse and the chorus, and he was the one that came up with that. I don't know, I moved out of the frame, but he came up with that bridge, where it hits the sixth chord and then down, that whole chord, like Beatles sounding thing there. But that just really touched me, the way my mom loved me more than herself.
Yeah. JC, I spent an hour with this documentary yesterday, and it's proving to be absolutely true. The impression that I took away from this is that this is a story of grace and gratefulness from a man who, by all rights, has a reason to be a little miffed at some of the things that life sent his way. That is not the case in any stretch of imagination. How did you find him to work with?
Oh, it was a terrific experience. Like you said, you know, you meet sometimes people that sort of seem nice, and they're kind of being fakey nice, you know what I'm talking about? But Rocky is just not that person. He really is genuinely kind and generous, and he's like that to everyone, not just to me because he knows me. He certainly helped me out over these many years that we worked on this documentary. We've become really good friends, and it's based on that. It's the kind of person that he is, his dedication to tribute to the troops, which I'm sure you may want to get into later, but that's just who he is. He's a generous, kind person who always looks out for the other person.
You're a whiz, Rocky, at guitar, and your musical experience, I think, if I got it right, began at a yard sale in which you asked your mom to buy you two albums. Which albums were they?
Well, we didn't really have any entertainment in the house. I think we had an AM radio. We didn't have a TV until I was in high school. But I think I was seven years old or something like that, and we went to the First Baptist Church yard sale in Statesville, North Carolina, and they had a phonograph, you know, all-in-one kind of phonograph, and two albums. Now, keep in mind, this was the Southern Baptist Church. I don't even think they knew what was in the albums, but it was Kiss Alive 1. And the Jimi Hendrix, Acts as Bold as Love, and they wanted a dollar for it. No, they wanted 75 cents, and my mom gave me a dollar. And then, but she was more concerned about getting her quarter back, which I made sure she did. But, you know, I'd like to address, Mike, that, you know, I think guitar playing is a lot like riding a motorcycle. I don't ever want to feel like I know what I'm doing on the guitar. I want to feel like I don't want to feel like, oh, I got this, or I know. I want to feel like there's stuff to learn and chances for me to. It's same with a motorcycle. The day you think you can ride a motorcycle really good, you probably ought to hang that key up, because you're really kind of just getting started. There's the world has given us such great guitar talents like Chet Atkins and Steve Warner and Jimi Hendrix, who we just talked about, and people like that. And my goal is to maybe play like those people one day in my life, but I don't feel like I'm one of those people.
I think you're being modest, and that's okay. You can be modest.
I would disagree with that. I'll jump in and disagree with that as well. I think he's one of the greats. Everybody sees this documentary, Mike. That's the first thing they say to me. They say, wow, that Rocky can play the guitar. I mean, they always, that's the first thing they notice. I mean, of course.
Yeah,
thank you for saying that.
And the documentary underlines this. They feature you on several different guitar solos, including this one.
And it wasn't one of these things where he was like going, oh, I got to sit down and I've got to practice. This is who I am. This is what I do. And, you know, he's an incredible player. Well, he got that way because next to eating and sleeping, that's pretty much what he does, you know.
I would watch him spend 6 to 8 hours a day running scales, running licks, running sweeps, perfecting his fingering. It was scientific precision and mathematical exactness that he pursued in a musical instrument. It was inspiring. I've never seen that, ever.
Those were, and that isn't even the most impressive guitar solo in the documentary, but those were comments about you from keyboardist Billy Welsh and studio owner Mark Ray. Practicing 8 hours a day is a lot. I mean, you say at one point in the documentary that you sometimes woke up and discovered that the guitar was still around your neck. How long has this been going on?
It kind of still is, Mike. I see it as a ever love. I'd have to tell you, I'm emotional by that thing that you put together there. You took the time to say those, put those pieces together and make it. Like it was, it means the world to me. I appreciate that. But I practice all the time every day. I still take every day, spend time on it, trying to figure it out.
And you went to LA because as you said, you wanted to be like Eddie Van Halen, and you did. You ended up playing in these groups that played some of the big clubs in LA, like the Troubadour, which is that's a pretty big deal. Why the transition to country?
Well, I moved to LA because when I went to high school here at North Iredell High School in Iredell mm-hmm. County, I was one of the two guitar players there that everybody thought could play a little bit. And then when I went to the Army, and I'm not bragging or nothing, but in my barracks, I was maybe the best guitar player in my barracks. And that was my whole view of the world at that point, was my high school and then the Army. And so when I went to California, I'd been the best guitar player at my barracks and the best guitar player in the high school, or maybe not the best, maybe one of the two. And then I got there, and my first day I had a little battery powered amp and a guitar, and I thought I'd go out there on the street and somebody would discover me. That's how naive I was. I thought I'd just sit out here and play. And I was out there right off of Yucca Street near Hollywood and Highland, playing in the little garden of the one room apartment I'd rented. And this man was doing yard work, and he kept watching me. And I thought he'd like my playing, so I'd play faster. And finally, he looked at me and he said, "There's a better way to do that." And I said, "There is." And I handed him my guitar. And this fellow had a rough life. You could see he had struggled in his life to get to the gardening job, even, I guess. And for the first time, my guitar, which has been with me my whole life since I'd bought it, made music. That boy played that guitar, and it wasn't just notes coming out. It was music, and it was beautiful. And that taught me a huge lesson. I went back up to my little room, and I said, "I'm going to dig in and try to learn this thing." And that's still how I feel about it today. Hmm.
That kind of happened to you once you went to Myrtle Beach too. You hooked up with a country singer, and he gave you a shot, and you played with him on stage. And he turned to you, and it was time for your solo, and you played your solo, and you say in the documentary that it was the worst guitar solo in the history of guitar solos.
Ever. Without a doubt. I was so nervous. I wanted to play in his band. His name was Mike Shane, and he was the first person that I realized the songs were about words. I heard that man sing, and it just moved me to my core. And I went up to him, and I said, "I got to play in this band." And he said, "Are you that kid from the Islander?" Because I had left, and I was playing at a place called the Islander. That was a jazz gig where we would play, like, you know, real book tunes, Misty and Girl from Ipanema, While People Would Eat, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Are you the boy they talk about the Islander?" And I said, "I hope so." And so he said, you start tomorrow night. And so that solo you're talking about, it was the first song he had played. And I just wanted to impress him. And all I really did was just show off and play the worst solo ever.
Except after the show was over, he took you out to his car and handed you a cassette. What did he say?
He said, here's the Vern Gosden Chiseled in Stone album. If you learn how to play this, you'll know how to play country music. And so I didn't sleep that night. I went back to my trailer I was renting, and I worked on it and worked on it. And the next night when he would sing those Vern Gosden songs, I'd play those licks, and I played those same licks on the other country songs we were playing. And then at the end of the night, that night, he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, I didn't mean learn it in one night, Rocky.
You know, that it strikes me that that is who you are. I mean, other people may have, particularly people who are as accomplished as you are at the guitar, and you are, might have taken umbrage at his suggestion that you listen to this cassette, but you took it to heart and you adopted it. And how did you find the humility to do that?
Well, you know, Mike, you said earlier that you were a linear thinker, and I'm a person that, to be completely frank with you, I don't really have any natural musical talent. I just have a love, a deep, deep, deep love for it. I don't know if you know who Ben Hogan was. He's a golfer who it's written about him that he didn't have a lot of natural talent either. He just overcame it by working harder than anybody else. And so what I've done, like I play in a band. If you come see my band now, you'll be blown away. Everybody in that band's better than me. Every single one of them. And that was when I started getting in bands, I made sure that I always played with people that were a lot better than me. And since I don't have it from a natural perspective, I try to get it by putting the time in and putting the effort in to learn it. So it's more of a learned thing than it is a talent thing, I think.
You talked about that experience with the singer in Myrtle Beach. It was the first time you said that you realized that the songs were about the lyrics, the words. You had up to that point always waded through the lyrics for your solo, because that's what it was about, the guitar solo. And now when I watch tapes of you singing with your band, yeah, you still do these solos, but when you're singing, the guitar playing that you're doing is pretty simple in comparison to the solos. You're really giving the words their due. Do you find that difficult to suppress, that desire to really show off on the guitar, or is it something that it comes naturally to you now that you've realized that the songs are about the words?
Well, you know, it's flipped over the years and things that we've been doing, Mike, because now it's really the stories of the song are everything. And as I got into country music and I fell in love with that style of music and ended up living in Nashville for decades, the song has just become, here's the thing about songs. Like this is why I think tribute bands and cover bands are so popular now, because a really good singer, which I'm not, can sell you a bad song. Like they can write an okay song and have this beautiful voice and you'll walk away thinking that's pretty good. But any singer, no matter how good or bad or awful they are, if they sing Bridge Over Troubled Water or a Bob Dylan song or a Hank Williams song, it's still a great song, and you know it's a great song. So the song is really the benchmark that we're going for. So it's, to me, the lyrics are now the most important part.
And you are a songwriter now. Maybe you weren't back in the early days, but you are now, and you say that you write almost every day, if not every day. How much of what you write eventually becomes a song versus ending up on the cutting room floor that just didn't work or didn't go anywhere or whatever?
A long time ago, I decided to finish every song that I start. So even if it is a cutting room floor song, I try to finish it. And I think songwriting's like throwing darts. Like if I gave you a dart and I had a dart and we had a board back there, I'd probably miss the board altogether and you'd hit the board. But if I gave you 1,000 darts, Mike, by the time we got to 300 or 400, we'd be figuring it out, you know? And by the time that we hit the end, we might be a pretty good dart player. And so I don't know if songwriting is something you ever really get good at. It's kind of like practice in medicine. You're always practicing songwriting.
Well, that song, More, that we played a little snippet of earlier, people talked about that song at the record company that first released it as being the perfect song. And it was
the song that got me signed. I sung that song for Doug Morris, and he signed me right after I sung it.
And you have written for yourself. You've also written for other artists. When you hear other people singing your material, or when you hear it on the radio, what does that do for you? What's that experience like?
I'm humbled by any time that anybody would care to listen to one of my songs or to record one of them. I know the first time that I heard Steve Warner sing Arrows at Airplanes, that I'd been lucky enough to be part of the writing of that song, I wept. I mean, man, if you think about it, brother, growing up trying to, where you don't even have a television. I mean, those are dreams. Every one of those things that you talked about, going through the Army, living in California, those are all dreams. And so that's why for the movie, I definitely didn't want it to look like, you know, well, his record, I didn't become Tim McGraw, and I obviously didn't become Eddie Van Halen, but I became me. And maybe that's more important than trying to be somebody else.
The song we heard a little while ago, More, was on your first album, and it was, it was on your first album. As I said, it was praised for being the perfect song, a career maker, and yet the record company went under, and so it kind of dwindled. But before it went under, they decided to release another song first off that album called Lipstick.
Well, enough of this nonsense, baby. We're bigger than this. Let's get back to us and the thrill we felt with our first kiss. You know the road can take us out where we both feel so alive. Let's go tonight. You can put your lipstick on while I drive. We can go down to so spend the night in New Orleans. Go out to California like we've always dreamed. Making love out in the desert. I can watch the sunset in your eyes. Let's go tonight. You can put your lipstick on while I drive.
That song, Lipstick, actually charted in the 20s. The next song they released off the album also charted, and then the record company folded. When we come back, we'll hear more of Rocky Lynn Rash's story in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Rocky Lynn Rash today. He's a Statesville native, many songs to his credit, many albums to his credit, 14 appearances on the Grand Ole Opry. His documentary about him, Rocky Lynn, Where I Belong, is now streaming on Amazon Prime, and he's just released a new album called Love. I just played Lipstick, which was your first, I guess it was your first charted record, and then they released another one off that same album, and then the record company went under. You're a guy who's on a rocket ship that has left the launch pad, and suddenly it runs out of fuel. What does that do to somebody? Because you think, this is it, I've made it.
Well, you know, I think there's a couple ways to look at it, Mike. You did a show once a long time ago. I listened about a fellow that went to dog shows. He went to the like the big fancy dog shows and he went to 100 of them, and he started making these comparisons, and he wrote a book about it. And it was all about how this, you know, the dogs don't even know if they want to be there, and the people, and how they call it a sport, but it's not. Anyway, I don't remember exactly what he says, but the music business is a lot like a great big dog show. And so I was on a bus opening for Carrie Underwood, my whole band and crew, and then the bottom had fallen out of the economy, and my record label, Universal Records South in Nashville, right, closed its doors. And so the next day, all that was gone. Every bit of it was gone. Now, some people, and I've been have interviews where this one man, he was for a book, he was interviewing me, and he said, "Well, how'd you feel when your record deal was a failure?" And I was taken aback by the question because I never saw it as a failure at all. Before I got a record deal, Mike, I was singing in casinos and honky tonks and Bob's Piggly Wiggly grand openings. I mean, I was doing whatever you could play, and then afterward, I was singing to people that actually wanted to hear my songs and my stories. Now, I wasn't singing at the Spectrum Center, but I was still singing where people cared. And that I'd spent 20 years entertaining people that didn't want to be entertained. And that's probably the best proving ground any singer can go through, because I would try to spend 20 minutes pulling you away from a slot machine or from talking at the bar to maybe listen to me. And once you can learn to grab somebody's attention, if you can somehow be fortunate enough to get somebody in a chair so they would pay your attention, that's an easy job then.
I'm glad you brought up the joy of playing in front of people who care, who really want to hear you sing. As we've mentioned, you are obsessed with the guitar. You're also obsessed with motorcycles, and you've used that obsession to start a nonprofit charity called Tribute to the Troops. The idea came from a song that you've been performing for a long time called Home, which you say was inspired by your time serving in the Army.
18 and called for duty, God and country and fellow man. Beaches made for beauty are covered with bloody grains of sand. Mothers, hide your children, there's danger in this land. And Father, please forgive me, for I know not who I am. Fly home, my sweet angel, from sea to shine.
So you sing that song and others, and you raise money for your nonprofit charity called Tribute to the Troops. How do you raise money for that charity, and how is that money used?
Well, our Tribute to the Troops organization is a 100% volunteer organization. It has been for the last 20 years. And so people volunteer their time, I went in the Army right after high school. The day after high school, I was on a bus headed to Fort Benning, Georgia. And I went in the Army, I'd like to say, and I feel like I'm a patriotic person, but I joined the Army because I wanted to go to California and go to that guitar school. That's the reason that I joined. That's the whole reason. And because they would help me with their college assistance programs. And I went through basic training and all my stuff, and I was at Fort Bragg, and I'd only been at Fort Bragg for a couple days when they activated our unit to go to Grenada. Up till that moment, Mike, I was playing football. It wasn't like it was real to me. I didn't think we would actually ever do that. The men who were my drill sergeants and the people in the Army that taught me were all Vietnam guys. I went in 83. So all the people who are higher-ranking non-commissioned officers, the senior non-commissioned officers, the staff sergeants, the platoon sergeants, they were all people who had been to Vietnam. And I was not a kid who ever, you know, was doing the drinking and the drugs and that kind of – I didn't do that. But I had no direction. And those men pointed me in the right direction. They said, get up every day, make your bed, go to work, build something. And now here I am later in my life sitting talking to you about a record in a movie. That's all because those men pointed me in that right direction.
J.C.
So I wrote the song. Go ahead.
I was just going to say J.C. Somerford is here. She's the writer, producer, director, and creator of this documentary called Rocky Lynn, Where I Belong, which is about you. And in the course of that documentary, J.C., you take us to some of these events that Rocky hosts for the families of fallen veterans, where they light candles for every person who has lost their life. They say their names. He comforts them. I mean, it's very touching. From your perspective, what does his visit, his charitable work toward those ends, his music mean to these people?
Well, it means everything. I mean, you could just see some of the scenes that we show of the families hugging and crying, and Rocky's right there with them, hugging and crying, and they just appreciate it so much because, as he says, so many times, you know, the army comes or the military comes after the person has died and comforts the family and that this and that. Maybe they have a ceremony or something somewhere, but then it's forgotten. And, you know, years later, that family is still suffering. So the whole idea was that, I believe, is that we will never forget you. We will not forget you ever at
exactly.
all. And so following up with helping the children get through college with some funding as well. So it's a commitment that we will not forget you, like it seems like everyone else has. And they appreciate that so much, Rocky, don't they? That's what they respond to.
Well, I realize I wasn't answering Mike's question. You're right, J.C. So what Tribute to the Troops is, the first time that they asked me to go overseas, I went in 2005 over to Afghanistan and Iraq to sing songs. And so that's where I wrote the songs for Soldier's Record, because I didn't want to go over and say, oh, look at me, and here's me singing Lipstick, because I wanted to thank them. Those are the gentlemen that put me on the right, gentlemen and women that put me on the right direction. So I wrote the songs for Soldier's Record, and you ask about how we raise money. We raise, people donate money to us, and every time we would sell a songs for Soldier, we put that money into our coffers to try to help. And over the years, thanks to all the people that come to our events and do stuff, we've raised well over $1 million and helped 123 children go to college.
Once again, this seems to circle back to the love that you feel for your adoptive mother and the feeling of being grateful for almost everything. I mean, you're grateful to your military for your military experience for teaching you certain things, and you're paying it back. We only have 7 minutes left, so I don't want to. I could spend an hour talking about that, but I want to talk about what you discovered along the way and what we are privy to in this documentary, Rocky Lynn, Where I Belong, because you spent years looking for your biological family, and then one day you heard from your biological sister, and you discovered that you had three sisters and a brother, and that your biological father was still alive. How did all that happen? How did you find these people?
Well, my dear friend Kathleen Martin bought me a 23andMe DNA test for my birthday. It was a birthday present. And so we signed up on that system, and they found, like you said, my sister, and we met her first. She had been on the in that program and she was the one that led us to be able to be introduced to my father. So he was a Korean War veteran, just like my adopted father. And when we met, he was very nervous about DNA, and he wasn't sure he believed in it. So we met in a public place at a restaurant, and within 10 minutes, Mike, it was obvious that he was my father.
Yeah, because this is amazing, because you talk about your father, he was a guitar player. In a country band. He was a paratrooper in the same unit that you were a paratrooper in, the 82nd Airborne. He rode motorcycles. What does that tell you?
His whole life. His whole life he rode motorcycles.
And you do, too.
One of the first, I do. Yeah, that Tribute to the Troops, I guess I didn't say that. We started on motorcycles. We go stand in the yards where the young men grew up, where they died. Before they died, when they had a life, and we say we will remember, because every day is Memorial Day at those people's homes. But within just a few minutes, my dad took my hand around the wrist, and he grabbed it kind of hard, and he looked at me and he said, "If I'd have known you was in that place, I'd have come and got you any minute." He meant it with all of his heart.
That place being Berrien Springs Children's Home. He did not know that you existed.
He had no idea. He had never known that. And right before he passed, I was with him in his home in Miller's Creek, North Carolina, and he had a picture of me playing on the Grand Ole Opry by his bed, and had my record that they would play, and all of our brothers and sisters were there, our whole family, and I was able to be with him in that time when he was transitioning, and I'll never, ever, I can't even put into words how much that meant to me, Mike.
Before he passed, and I guess at some point between that and the time you first met him, and he didn't know you existed, he gave you his prized Martin D35 guitar. And you wrote about it. You wrote about it. Let's hear a bit of My Father's Guitar.
My father's guitar laid silent in the closet of his home in Miller's Creek. His hands no longer played the way they used to. I guess he was keeping it from me. Back when he was younger on the road, he took it everywhere, or so I'm told. Honky-tonks and bars, out among the stars, there never was a song he didn't know. My father's guitar laid silent in the closet of his home in Miller's Creek. His hands no longer played the way they used to. I guess he was keeping it for me.
Are you playing that Martin D35 on that song?
I wrote it on that song, and I played it on that song. I guess I didn't tell you, the reason my sister joined the 23andMe or me was because as she was passing away, her mother said, you should look out there. You might have some siblings out there, because, he played guitar his whole life. Yeah. Whenever that's what he did. He was playing at the honky-tonks and clubs. And when Melinda told me that, the last verse of that song, he called himself a rounder. That's what it says. Let's see.
I hate to tell you this. I hate to tell you this, Rocky, but no. Well, that and the fact that sometimes on Zoom we have trouble with music for some reason. We can't hear it. I had a pianist on here, and when he would play, and nothing was coming out. And I'm very sorry for that.
That's all right. I was just saying that he said he called himself a rounder all his life, and that's how the last verse ends on it.
He didn't know you existed because your birth mother evidently had a quick relationship, and she was in a family in Virginia, a prominent family in Virginia. And they weren't having any of that. And she got pregnant out of wedlock. Her father was a district court judge. And he's the person that took you from her and put you on the doorstep of the Berrien Springs home for children. You later met, I guess, your brother from your mother's side of the family and discovered that she did not abandon you, and in fact came and checked up on you constantly.
My mother thought that my adopted mother thought that the social services people were checking in on us, but actually it was my birth mother, Shirley Sturgill. She would look in the window, and then she would go back and tell. I spent my whole life thinking that my mother had abandoned me and that I was not a. For some reason or another, she didn't want me. And I'd learned to forgive that and to love beyond that. But then come to find out, she spent the rest of her life telling everybody about me because I was her first child. Yeah. And so I was loved all along.
And she told her family that you were okay, that you were with good people. So clearly she cared. Rocky Lynn Rash, his new documentary is called Rocky Lynn, Where I Belong, produced and written by J.C. Summerford. His new album out is called Love. And in this world, at this time in our existence, I can't think of a better thing to look at to learn about grace and gratefulness. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.